Hi, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And it's a real blessing to have David Seeloff with us. You can access the website at this address, askelm.com. That's askelm.com. And you can email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And David Seeloff is the director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And today we begin part 12 in the series that we're doing on the Star of Bethlehem, the star that astonished the world. And this is quite an informative series, a real blessing. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne, and hello to everyone out there.
Yes.
Yeah, we're having a great time. There's 13 chapters in this book, and we're on chapter 12, and we'll also deal with one of the appendices, which is relevant. The other material, the other three appendices, are extremely technical and not really relevant to things that many people are interested in. But they're available on the website. The entire book is available online. But this chapter, chapter 12, deals with the census that's talked about in Luke, the census of Quintilius Varus. Now, I'm reading the material written by Dr. Ernest L. Martin. And actually, some people have misunderstood that. They think I'm, and of course, sometimes I read my own material, but I think all but once I've mentioned whether I'm reading my material or Dr. Martin's, but almost always it's Dr. Martin's material that I'm reading and going over because it's of such high quality, and my job was to, is to go over this material, even the earlier material from the 1970s, and rework it and re-edit it and bring it up to date and footnote it and explain certain things and do what an editor does. But this is chapter 12, the census of Quintilius Varus. And so let's get to it. Luke said that Jesus was born at a census when Quirinius, which in the King James is called Cyrenius, was a ruler in Syria. This reference has been an enigma to historians for generations because no such census of Quirinius has been found by historians, which could have occurred any time from the period of 7 to 1 BC. Scholars have stated that Luke simply did not know what he was talking about, and that he probably got his facts mixed up with the census of Quirinius that indeed took place in 6 to 7 AD. There is undisputed evidence that Quirinius was governor beginning in 6 to 7 AD, and that he conducted a census at that time. And even Luke mentions it in Acts 5, verse 37. But up to now, no available information has been discovered to show that Quirinius was an administrator and a census taker in 3-2 BC or in previous years. This new historical research, however, can find that census of Quirinius in the historical records which took place at Jesus' nativity. In the New Testament, Luke actually states that the census was an enrollment or a registration of some kind. He does not say that Quirinius' census, what it was for. But now we can discover the reason for this census. Let us recall that from the last chapter that the early church father Tertullian said that Roman records supported the fact that censuses, he used the plural, were conducted in Palestine at the time of Jesus' birth. But But Tertullian said that they took place at the time when Saturninus was governor of Syria. Tertullian, though, said nothing about Quirinius as conducting those censuses. This early Christian scholar also identified the year with that which we now reckon as 3 to 2 BC. If the biblical narrative given to us by Luke and that of Tertullian can be married together, how could it be that two governors, Saturninus and Quirinius, were then in Syria at the same time? Well, this poses a problem, and it has been a problem for a long time. Perhaps Josephus provides a clue to help us straighten out the mystery. The historian Josephus mentioned that actually there were governors, plural, in Syria during the rule of Saturninus. And he says this in Antiquities, Book 16, paragraphs 280, 285, 357, and 361, several places. And while during the early governorships of Titius and Quintilius Varus, Josephus spoke of a governor, singular. And this is in Antiquities of the Jews, Book 17, paragraph 89, section 89. But during the administration of Saturninus, why does Josephus mention the plural governors? How many governors were there at this time? Well, Josephus mentions the names of Saturninus and Volumnius. Were these the only men to whom Josephus was referring? Or could Quirinius be considered as well? Quirinius Varus. Since it is clear that Saturninus was the regular governor, it must be held that the rule of Quirinius was of a different and special nature. Such special status could well accord with the other types of commands that Quirinius held as attested to in the historical records. Quirinius' war against the Homodensines, for which Tacitus singled him out for praise, the Roman historian Tacitus, has been called a, quote, special command, end quote. And this is mentioned by Tacitus. This status is also reflected in an inscription which mentions Quirinius, quote, as holding an honorary municipal office at Antioch by Pisidia, end quote. And it was certainly a special command for Quirinius when he became rector of the young Gaius Caesar, when Gaius acquired residential authority at Antioch over the eastern provinces in 1 AD. Gaius was probably not strictly called the governor of Syria at the time, that he was there from 1 to 4 AD. And it may well be that Quirinius was responsible for running the everyday affairs of government. Tacitus said that Quirinius was one who had, quote, considerable talents for business, end quote. And this could account for his selection as being the guardian of Gaius Caesar, who was the designated heir to the empire. Also, as our historical reconstruction shows, Quirinius already had experience in Syria by administering the censuses about in 3 to 2 BC, which took place during the time when Saturninus was governor. All these references indicate special commands for Quirinius throughout his entire governmental career. And there are other historical records about Quirinius which show his special assignments. Quirinius, for example, was a special delegate. This special status of Quirinius is also suggested when he later became governor of Syria in 6 to 7 AD. Josephus said that he was given the rank of dikaiodotes, or a governor, but in the sense of one having extraordinary judicial powers. The word dikaiodotes means a judge. Professor Feldman, quoting J.A.O. Larson in the Loeb edition of Josephus, states, quote, that the word diakadotes is found only in Antiquities, Book 18, Section 1, and in the inscriptions from Lycia, in the sense of being, quote, governor, end quote. Larson plausibly suggests that the word was not so much a title for a governor as an honorary appellation, much like soter, or ruler, or iurgetes. I'm butchering the Latin. It would emphasize the high regard with which the governor was held as an honest judge. The duties of the governor, in Lydia at least, were largely judicial, end quote. Quirinius, then, was even an unusual type of administrator in Syria. Syria, by the way, was a huge Roman province, very rich, and the people controlling it were very powerful. It had probably more than one administrator, for sure. And it also oversaw the other administrations, this is an aside by me, it oversaw other administrations of the other provinces that were farther to the east and to the north, and also to the south, from Syria. So Syria was the headquarters province that overlooked other provinces. Well, Quirinius then was even an unusual type of administrator, back to Dr. Martin's text, in Syria during the period of 6 to 7 AD. It could be said that he had special and probably extensive powers directly from Augustus Caesar. He could have been called, in contemporary terms, a powerful man Friday for Augustus, or officially, a legatus Augusti. This certainly must be the case. When Quirinius conducted the census at the time of Saturninus, Justin Martyr said that Roman historical records showed Quirinius as being a procurator in Judea. Justin dated this political role of Quirinius to the time when Jesus was born. Since Justin Martyr was a second century author referring to Roman records, it is reasonable that he must have been acquainted with the various Roman titles afforded to eminent officials. It's a shame that Justin's reference that Quirinius was a procurator at the time of Jesus' nativity and not a governor has seldom been mentioned by historians, but its implication is of profound importance. A procurator was normally a personal advocate of the emperor with special authority quite distinct from the residential governor of a Roman province. This indication of Justin may have significance to our question concerning Quirinius. The Cambridge Ancient History, Volume 10, page 216, has an interesting comment on the role of a Roman procurator. Quote, each province had its equestrian procurator, who in the eyes of the provincials was almost as important as the governor himself, end quote. These procurators were appointed by the emperor quite independently of the legatus, the governor, and the relations between the two were frequently none too friendly. In the fact that Justin Martyr said that Quirinius was a procurator while conducting the census gives a great deal of weight to the belief that a resident Roman governor also ruled at Syria at the same time. It looks like Luke was well aware of the fact that Quirinius was in Palestine conducting a registration of peoples when Saturninus was the actual governor of Syria. And Dr. Martin says he will soon discuss why biblical translators erroneously call Quirinius a governor. So why was there a census or registration in 3 to 2 BC? Well, we have no early historical information other than Luke and Tertullian that a census of the Roman world took place in 3 to 2 BC. Augustus, with his own hand, composed an account of major events in his own life. He wrote of the official censuses in 28 BC, in 8 BC, and in 14 AD. And this is in his book, Res Gestae. In book 2, section 8. But nothing of the year 3 to 2 BC under discussion. Yet in his gospel, Luke said that the entire Roman world was involved in some kind of census. Why was there an empire registration of peoples in 3 to 2 BC of which Luke speaks? And why doesn't Augustus mention it? Well, when one recalls the history of that period, particularly what happened in 2 BC, we may well have the reason for such a registration. Recall that in chapter 1 of this book, The Star That Astonished the World by Dr. Martin, he pointed out that in the year 2 BC, there was one of the most important and glorious in the career of Augustus Caesar. It was the silver jubilee of his supreme rule over the empire, and the year in which the Senate awarded him the country's highest decoration as being the pater patriae, the father of the country. And there was no year like it for majestic celebrations in Rome. And since the significance of the festivities involved the entirety of the empire, there can be no doubt that similar anniversary ceremonies were ordained by Augustus and the Senate for all the provinces in the empire. It should be remembered that back in 27 BC, Augustus was given complete and absolute allegiance by the Senate and the people of Rome. Would there not have been a renewal of their loyalty to Augustus in the Jubilee year? If so, we could well have a reference to that empire registration of loyalty to the emperor. Josephus mentioned that Augustus demanded an oath of allegiance about 12 or 15 months after the death of King Herod of Judea. This event would fit nicely with a decree going out from Augustus Caesar in 3 BC that all were to be given that all people were to give an oath of allegiance to him at some designated time during the year. Obviously, the recording of the oaths, where people ascribed their names, was a type of registration. And this is what Luke said the census was. It was an enrollment of people. The oath, in fact, was a census. If the oath of loyalty mentioned by Josephus is what brought Joseph and Mary to Bethlehem, and Dr. Martin will quote the text in a moment, Mary had to accompany Joseph. In a regular census, Mary would not have needed to go with Joseph, nor would Joseph have needed to travel so far. Some have suspected that both Joseph and Mary were descendants of David and were legitimate claimants to the throne of Israel, had such a throne existed at the time. It could easily be seen why Mary, as well as Joseph, was expected to sign the oath of loyalty to Augustus. All royal claimants would have especially been singled out to give the oath of allegiance. And the idea is once you sign that oath, you are even more legally bound should you turn against that and rebel.
Yeah,
because
David, isn't it interesting that in the Gospels, Jesus says, take no oaths, doesn't he? Something to that effect?
Yeah, that's pretty much in a court context, though.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would apply in this case.
Okay.
Because there's certainly no condemnation, and all the Jews did that, apparently, at the time. So they didn't rebel against doing so. That's an interesting point, though. That's an interesting point. You have to look at the context of what Jesus said that. It's interesting. Because they didn't swear to God. They swore to Augustus.
Yeah.
And at that time, Augustus did not require that the Jews considered him a god. So there may have been an out there, especially because King Herod was on the throne at that time. Well, King Herod had just died. But in any case, as I said, all royal claimants would have especially been singled out to give the oath of allegiance, and this would have even involved Mary. It was possible in Jewish circles for female descendants of David to have the rights of primogeniture and kingship for their offspring. And this is made clear in the book Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus in book 18, section 124, and also in Acts 16, verses 1 to 3, where the principles of legal maternal descent are shown. Luke tells us, the gospel writer Luke tells us that the reason why both Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem was because he was reckoned as belonging to the house of David, while everyone else went, quote, into his own city, end quote. As it says in Luke 2, verse 3, no doubt in their own neighborhoods, those of the royal Judaic lineage, because of the political implications, they had to register in Bethlehem. This requirement would allow King Herod to know who all the claimants were in Judea to the royal throne of David. He was anxious also to know who all these people were in order to keep them subjected to thorough non-political functions. In other words, keep them safe in non-political functions so that King Herod's own dynasty could survive. This was especially important at this time in history because there was then a great deal of messianic expectation among the Jews. Registering David's descendants in Bethlehem, in the city of David, would have been a ploy not only to get all the people to attend for prestige purposes, but for King Herod to find out who they were. Since Augustus had ordered that an oath of allegiance be given to him, King Herod simply included himself and the legitimacy of his kingdom within the same oath. And since females among the Jews could give Davidic heirship to their descendants, King Herod included the women as well. This would have given him a complete record of all such claimants to the throne. This could well be why Mary was expected to accompany Joseph. And now we're going to look at that oath of loyalty mentioned by Josephus in great detail. Josephus referred to the second and the ordinary census conducted by Quirinius in 6 AD. But what about the first one, which Tertullian said took place at the time of Saturninus, who was governor of Syria in 3 to 2 BC. Well, Professor Lardner, as early as the 18th century, was convinced that Josephus mentioned this one as well. The oath referred to in Josephus and the registration of Luke may be one and the same, and the best thing to do is to quote the remarks of Josephus about the oath in their entirety. And this is found in Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, Book 17, Sections 41 to 45. And this is a long quote, but we should go through it. It is interesting. Quote, there were, moreover, a certain sect of Jews who valued themselves highly for their exact knowledge of the law, and talking much of their contact with God, were greatly favored with the women in King Herod's court. They are called Pharisees. They are men who had it in their power to control kings, extremely subtle and ready to attempt anything against whom they did not like.
What's changed?
When, therefore, the whole Jewish nation took an oath to be faithful to Caesar and to the interests of the king, meaning King Herod, these men, to the number of above 6,000, refused to swear. Here you go, exactly addressing your question.
Yeah.
The king, having laid a fine upon them, Pheroras' wife, he was King Herod, she was King Herod's sister-in-law. Pheroras' wife paid the money for them. They, in requital for her kindness, for they were supposed by their great intimacy with God to have attended to the gift of prophecy. In other words, they had were believed to have the gift of prophecy. They prophesied that God, having decreed to put an end to the government of Herod and his race, in other words, all his descendants, the kingdom would be transferred to her and Pheroras and their children. Well, this probably didn't go over too well with the king. We'll see. Salome, the one who had John the Baptist killed, Salome, King Herod's sister, perhaps this is a different Salome. Salome, Herod's sister, who was aware of all that was being said, came and told the king about them. She also told him that many in the court of King Herod, were corrupted by them, meaning the Pharisees. Then the king put to death the most guilty of the Pharisees, and Bagoas, the eunuch, and one Charis, the most beautiful young man about the court, and the great instrument in the king's unlawful pleasures. He, meaning King Herod, likewise slew every one of his own family who adhered to those things which were said by the Pharisees. But Bagoas had been elevated by them and was told that he should someday be called father and benefactor of the new king, who was to be appointed according to their prediction. For this king would have all things in his power, that he, meaning the king, would give him, Bagoas, the capacity of marriage and of having children of his own. Well, Bagoas was a eunuch, but there is a prediction about a eunuch at the time of the coming of the Messiah being able to bear children. Well, in any case, back to Dr. Martin's text, we ended the quote of Josephus. Back to the text by Dr. Martin. More than 6,000 Pharisees refused to take the oath of allegiance to Augustus and to Herod. And as Josephus stated, this was because of their belief that the Messiah and his age was just on the horizon. As said before, Lardner went so far as to suggest that this oath of allegiance and the census mentioned by Luke were one and the same, and it may well be true. There is a similarity in the wording within the two sources. Note how the two texts are worded when placed beside each other. First, notice Josephus. Quote, when therefore the whole Jewish nation took an oath to be faithful to Caesar and to the interests of the king, above 6,000 Pharisees refused to swear. Now, compared with the comments of Luke, as translated from the original Greek, quote, now, in those days, a decree was issued by Caesar Augustus that all the world should be registered or enrolled. And this was the first registration when Quirinius was ruling from Syria. End quote. Well, certainly the reference in Josephus to the oath must be looked on as of some kind of registration, swearing of loyalty, a swearing of royal loyalty to Augustus and to Herod. How does one show loyalty? It is done by doing the will of the ruler and giving him devotion, paying one's share of taxes for the upkeep of the government as demanded, and recognizing the legality of the regime. And no time in the Roman world would have been better for such an oath than the year preceding the Silver Jubilee celebrations. It could even have been called a census as well as a registration, because the recording of an oath of allegiance from all people required the ascribing of their names to obey Augustus and Herod. How else did Josephus know that over 6,000 Pharisees refused to take that oath, unless some kind of record of their number had been made? Well, the census is now identified. Once the chronology of the period is properly understood, it can be seen that the oath would have been required about 12 to 15 months before the death of King Herod. Anyone reading the narrative of Josephus without preconceived opinions would have to put it somewhere in that range of time. This oath would have been given during the governorship of Saturninus, and that is the exact period when Tertullian said the registration of Judea was conducted. Coupled with this is the fact that Luke called this census the first registration. It could mean that he was distinguishing this census from the second or ordinary census of Quirinius, which took place in 6 to 7 AD, or that this was the first registration of its kind that ever took place. The latter reason has the best credentials. The truth is, the oath mentioned by Josephus and the census of Luke are no doubt one and the same. All fits perfectly if the registration was ordered by Augustus in the summer of 3 BC to be completed by autumn of 2 BC, during the year in which he was acclaimed the Pater Patriae. We will see that this was the first time that Augustus ever ordered all in the empire to show such loyalty. When the universal registration by Luke is dated to 3 BC, a flood of light comes on the scene showing several Roman references to it. Since Luke said it was Augustus who gave the decree for an empire-wide registration, perhaps we should let Augustus tell us with his personal statement about a political accounting of peoples that involved the empire. This took place in 3 BC, just when Luke said a registration occurred. And when Josephus shows, the Jews gave their oath to Augustus. This was the first time the emperor had the whole Roman Empire award him the title of Pater Patriae, Father of the Country. We have a record from Augustus that an empire-wide registration indeed took place in 3 BC. Augustus received his prestigious title of Pater Patriae on February 5th, 2 BC, which was the Day of Concord on the Roman religious calendar. But in what legal way did Augustus obtain this title? In the Res Gestae, the book composed by Augustus himself, he wrote, quote, "While I was administering my 13th consulship, the Senate and the Equestrian Order and the entire Roman people gave me the title Father of my Country." Now, end quote. Within the empire, there were over 4 million Roman citizens. For the totality of the citizenry to approve the bestowal of the Pater Patriae must have involved an empire-wide accounting. Since Augustus was officially given the award in early 2 BC, the registering of the citizens must have been decreed and began to be carried out sometime in 3 BC, considering travel time and the orders going out and the census being taken and the results coming back to Rome. In this universal registration of citizen approval regarding the fatherhood of Augustus and the recognition of supreme authority that the title signified, it is reasonable that all non-citizens in the empire also gave some kind of recognizable approbation within the same period of time. Since most people in Judea, in the empire, were not Roman citizens, Augustus could well have decreed in 3 BC that everyone should swear an oath of absolute obedience to him to accompany his majestic award as being father of the country. This would have been an appropriate gesture from all peoples in acknowledging their obedience to him by the time of his jubilee year of supreme power in 2 BC. Remarkably, an inscription found in Pamphlagonia, which is in North Central Asia Minor, that is clearly dated to 3 BC, records such an oath of obedience. Quote, taken by the inhabitants of Pamphlagonia and the Roman businessmen dwelling among them, end quote. And this is in Lewis and Reinhold's Roman Civilization book. The inscription states that Romans, as well as non-citizens, took the oath. And more importantly, the whole of the population were required to swear it. Quote, the same oath was sworn also by all the people in the land at the altars of Augustus, in the temples of Augustus, in the various districts. End quote. This is in the same book. This was in 3 BC. Also, in Judea, an oath was required of all the people at the same time, as shown by Dr. Martin's chronological reconstruction. This is a reasonable hint that the oath mentioned by Josephus was the same that the Roman people of Pamphlagonia were required to render. If so, then it could have been part of the empire-wide recognition of Augustus Pater Patriae. But there's other records about the census. The Armenian historian Moses of Kyrene said that the native sources he had available to him showed that in the second year of Abgar, king of Armenia, in 3 BC, the census mentioned by Luke brought Roman agents, quote, to Armenia, bringing the image of Augustus Caesar, which they set up in every temple, end quote. And this is in Thompson's Moses of Kyrene, History of the Armenians. This implied that the people had to go to the temples to register for the census. This information is very similar to that engraved on the Pamphlagonian inscription, also referring to 3 BC. That recorded the oath given to Augustus. The same oath was sworn by all the peoples in the land at the altars of Augustus, in the temples of Augustus, in the various districts. The similarity of language is so striking, since the year is exactly the same, it may mean that we have Armenian history showing that the registration mentioned by Luke did indeed occur in the year 3 BC. Agbar, the king of Armenia at this time, was a client king of the Romans, much the same way that King Herod was. The fact that the census of Luke was actually an empire-wide oath to Augustus was recognized by the historian Aristeus, who lived in the 5th century AD. He must have had early sources for his evidence as well. He wrote, quote, he, meaning Augustus, ordered that a census be taken of each province everywhere, and that all men be enrolled. Continuing on, this is the earliest and most famous public acknowledgement, which marked Caesar as the first of all men and the Romans as lords of the world, a published list of all men entered individually. Continuing on with Aristeus, the first and greatest census was taken, since in this one name of Caesar, all the peoples of the great nations took oath. And at the same time, through the participation in the census, were made a part of one society, end quote. Aristeus also identified the year for this enrollment and oath as being 3 BC. He said the oath was taken to enroll Augustus as, quote, the first of all men, end quote, an apt description of the bestowal of the Pater Patriae in his silver jubilee year, and when the priestly celebrations for the 750th year anniversary of Rome took place. The fact that Aristeus equaled the census with an oath of allegiance to Augustus may well mean that he had historical records that substantiated it, although Aristeus did not state so, that to be the case. The fact that oaths and censuses should go together should be no strange thing. Most Roman census declarations required an oath of allegiance to the emperor. One such declaration for property tax ended with, quote, "We swear by the fortune of the emperor Caesar Trajanus Hadrian Augustus, under oath," end quote. And another one, quote, "And I swear by the emperor Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus that I have kept nothing back," end quote. It is thus very reasonable that the census mentioned by Luke could well have been the oath referred to by Josephus, as well as Eresius, and the Pamphlagonian inscription. It thus seems highly probable that all people in the empire registered an oath of obedience and an approval of the Pater Patriae to Augustus at this time, and that Quirinius had been sent to the east to conduct that census for that section of the empire. This would mean that Quirinius possessed special powers that were different than those of the resident governor. And though the registration was decreed in 3 BC, and many took the oath at that time, there was no doubt a few months allowed for peoples to register their oaths because it was universal in application with all the people involved in the matter. It's reasonable that a period of about a year was allowed for the complete enrollment. Thus, Augustus' information in his Res Gestae, the Pamphlagonian inscription, the history of Armenia, Eresius, Josephus, and the statement of Luke historically blend together. There, I took some water. Luke said that, quote, "All the Roman world should be registered," in Luke 2 and verse 1, meaning the Roman world.
David, do you need to take a short break?
I don't think so, but, you know, we're not, no. Some have assumed that this registering was for taxation purposes, but Luke nowhere says that the payment of monies was the reason for the enrollment. Although an oath of obedience certainly involved financial accountability. There is clear evidence that the registration conducted by Quirinius was not for taxation. While King Herod was alive, none of the Jews in Judea paid any taxes to Rome. They paid them to Herod himself. This is made clear in the events immediately following King Herod's death. The Jews asked Archelaus, Herod's successor, to relieve them of excessive taxes. And this is in Josephus Antiquities 17, book 17, number 205. Had the Jews been paying taxes directly to Rome, brought about by the census of Quirinius, this request would have been irrelevant. From 63 BC to 47 BC, Judea was part of the province of Syria and paid tribute directly to Rome. But from 47 BC to 40 BC, Hyrcanus was the ruler of a free republic, as it says in Josephus. But the Jews still paid taxes directly to Rome. When Herod became king, however, the tribute to Rome stopped, and Herod collected all the taxes, but he also paid for his own armies. This continued until 6 to 7 AD, when direct taxation was again imposed upon those in Judea. This means that the registration by Quirinius in 3 to 2 BC was not strictly for tax purposes. This helps to show that it was primarily a census of loyalty to Augustus that all in the empire had to undertake in honor of Augustus' fatherhood of the country. The Pamphlagonian inscription called it an oath. Josephus called it an oath, and Luke simply called it a registration. There may be more evidence to support this. It was common for Roman citizens to have their citizen records their citizenship records checked every 5 years, like we have our driver's license renewed. There were both municipal records in Italy and in the provinces that registered citizenship status for Romans. When new citizens were enrolled, they were registered in the official tribal lists at Rome itself, in many cases in the archives of their own native cities and other important Roman centers throughout the Roman Empire. Roman citizenship at that time was a highly prized possession, and people wanted credentials of some kind to vouch for their title of citizenship. And this is made clear in Acts 22, verses 25 to 28. The registrations were checked and adjusted as to present circumstances, and adjusted to present circumstances every 5 years. Interestingly, we have clear evidence that Augustus had official censuses in 28 and 8 B.C.
He sounds like an early version of Big Brother.
Well, they had to. Look, when they couldn't bomb people, they had to do this by the sword,
yeah,
and by the spear point and by the arrow. And you had to keep a tight control. And even then, people constantly rebelled. Immediately after Herod died, there was a rebellion that we discussed in earlier chapters.
Yes.
You know, people always wanted their freedom. And, you know, Rome had to impose their rule on these nations. But everybody else imposed their rule on everybody else anyway.
Yeah.
Look what King Herod did to his own people, and not even his own people. So everybody had some type of oppression.
Today. The world has had such a long history of, these kind of rulers, David. It's
right.
I'll be so glad when Christ comes back.
Freedom exists only by degrees.
Yeah.
There is no such thing as absolute freedom.
Yeah.
But Augustus ran his official censuses in 28 and 8 B.C., and this was a 20-year interval, which is, of course, divisible by periods of 5 years. The next five-year time for checking would have indeed been 3 B.C., from 8 B.C. This was the precise year that the imperial oath recorded on the Pamphlagonian inscription took place, sworn to by both Roman citizens and native citizens of their respective countries and nations. Professor Sherwin White of Oxford University said it was customary for provincial Romans to have their citizenships checked or to renew imperial privileges at certain cities to which citizens politically belonged. The normal thing for Roman provincials was to quote, be registered in his native city, end quote. And this is in Sherman White's Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament, page 148. In Asia Minor, there were archive cities throughout the area where Roman imperial records were deposited. Many Roman provincials could prove their citizenship status by reference to these records. If the oath in Pamphlagonia was the same as the oath that Josephus said took place in Judea, and if both oaths were part of the census mentioned by Luke, then perhaps Luke's remark that, quote, everyone went into his own city, end quote, in Luke 2, verse 3, might make sense for Roman provincials as well as non-Romans. This fits well chronologically because all people periodically, and normally it was every 5 years, had to have their legal privileges or limitations checked at the, quote, archive cities, end quote. And 3 B.C. was an exact five-year period. This would help to show that this particular year was indeed a year in which a census or registration would have occurred even under ordinary circumstances. Now, recall that the official censuses involving taxation were in 28 B.C. and in 8 B.C. This was an exact 20-year period between the two censuses. And this is in Caesar Augustus' own writings. The next official census, according to Augustus, was in the year 14 AD. That is 21 years after 8 BC, not 20 years, as one might expect. Could it be that an entire year was dropped out of taxation, accounting, of the tax that dropped out of the taxation accounting during that period of time? Was the majestic silver jubilee year of 2 BC a non-taxable year? That certainly would have made Augustus very popular. If so, note what would have then have happened. The next five-year period for checking the personal affairs and effects of Romans would have been in 4 AD, and the next in 9 AD, followed, of course, by the regular census 5 years later in 14 AD. And interestingly, 4 and 9 AD were the exact years in which Augustus passed the social legislation pertaining to Roman citizens. If what I am saying, if what Dr. Martin says is true, in the time of Augustus, official censuses occurring every 20 years. This must be the case because Professor Vermesh and Millar report that the actual attested census for taxation was in 33 to 34 AD, and that is 20 years after the last official census of Augustus in 14 AD. All of the five-year periods between the 20-year censuses could be called minor censuses. The year 2 BC, however, was reckoned as so glorious, a new beginning for Augustus and for Rome, that it looks like imperial taxation and evaluation ceased during that year if people would give their oath of allegiance to Augustus as their pater patriae, and that they reckoned him as their universal lord. This could well be the case. It was not uncommon to remit some or all taxes at certain times. Remitting part or all taxes was not a new thing, especially if special circumstances were involved. King Herod, in order to honor his good fortune, and because he was in a cheerful mood, canceled a fourth part of taxes to the delight of his subjects. They went away with the greatest of joy, wishing the king all sorts of good things. And this took place, this is mentioned in Josephus' book, Antiquities, book 16, number 65. The Romans remitted taxes to the Jews during their sabbatical years. As Josephus mentions in the same passage, even within the Roman Empire, it was not uncommon to cancel taxes at times of national joy at the accession of a new emperor. Note that Alexander Severus cited a precedent of earlier emperors remitting certain taxations at times of accession. And if there was ever a time when Rome was in joy, a feeling that a new beginning and a new golden age was happening, it was the year 2 BC. Thus, it seems possible that the people taking the census or the oath for the pater patriae of Augustus were granted many fiscal immunities to accompany the joyful silver jubilee of the princeps and the 750th anniversary of Rome, as shown by the priestly records. This helps to show that the census of Luke was not for taxation purposes. It was for Augustus' exaltation to the pater patriae. All of this together indicates that the first census conducted by Quirinius in Herod's kingdom was for this reason. After all, while Herod was alive, he collected his own taxes, not Roman officials. But in 3 BC, Quirinius was a procurator, with unique powers from Augustus and responsible for conducting the special registration concerning the Pater Patriae for Augustus. It is just that simple. See how everything dovetails. Was Quirinius the governor in 2 BC? Well, that's one question that needs answering. Many translators of the New Testament render Luke chapter 2, verse 1, as though Quirinius were governor of Syria. But in no way does Luke state this in the original Greek text, although Dr. Martin says he indeed himself used to believe that. Luke simply said that Quirinius was ruling or administering his first registration from Syria, not that he was the governor of the province of Syria. The Greek word Luke used to show the rulership of Quirinius was hegemonateos. It is a present participle, which simply means that Quirinius was ruling or administrating his duties from the region of Syria. There is not the slightest indication in Luke's narrative that identifies the specific office being held by Quirinius while he was administering his official duties. In normal Greek usage of the time, the word hegemoneotos would refer to any type of rulership, from that of an exalted president or military commander, on down through the lesser offices to that of the local dog catcher in the city. The word could well refer to the fact that Quirinius was a procurator, as Justin Martyr says he was. Certainly, Quirinius was not the resident governor, as so many assume. In no way do the words of Luke mean such a thing. Indeed, shortly afterward, Luke, in chapter 3 and verse 1, referred to Pontius Pilate by the exact same word and in the exact grammatical structure. We know from a recent monumental discovery that Pontius Pilate was a prefectus Judaeae, not a senatorial legatus or governor who controlled one of the major provinces of the empire. The fact is, Luke's administrative description of Quirinius would dovetail nicely with those of a special procurator of Augustus, precisely as Justin Martyr said that Quirinius was. It is wrong to assume that Luke meant that Quirinius was the governor of the province of Syria. There is, however, one possibility that could have made Quirinius to be a temporary governor of sorts. Note that Josephus tells us that Saturninus was still governor of Assyria in the latter part of spring 2 BC. But by the following November, Quintilius Varus was then governor, and hearing the charges in Jerusalem against Antipater, the son of Herod, after Herod's death, or no, just before Herod's death. Josephus tells us specifically that Varus had lately taken over the governorship from Saturninus. This allows for a six-month period in which no one knows who was governor of Syria. This was the summer changeover period from one governor to the next. Could it be that Saturninus left Syria in late spring, handed affairs over to Quirinius for the changeover interval, and then Quintilius Varus took charge in late September or October of 2 BC? This is all possible. Yet there was yet no established custom near the time of Augustus for governors to be in their provincial seats of authority at set times of the year. The Roman orator Cicero left his province as governor before May 1st in 58 BC. His brother, however, did not leave Rome to take up his proconsulship until the early part of May. This example shows that sometimes parts of the summer period saw a province without its resident governor. Obviously, a lieutenant would have been in charge in some capacity during that period. In fact, Atkinson shows that it was common practice in for some of the summer months, not to have provincial governors in residence at all. Perhaps this is what occurred in the changeover period from Saturninus to Verus. In truth, there was a good reason why both Saturninus and Verus would have wanted to be in Rome for the summer of 2 BC. That year was one of great significance to the citizens of Rome and to those who lived within the empire. It was the silver jubilee of Augustus' ascension to total power and the year that he was proclaimed the Pater Patriae. This year was looked on as the apex of the Augustan peace, so everyone would have wanted to be there. Both Saturninus and Verus themselves would have wanted to be in Rome for the summer months, and both had an ace in the hand to do it. Quirinius was then in Syria, having conducted his procurator roles of conducting a registration of peoples. And since Quirinius was a man of high rank, and with the province having peace and security on all sides, to the north, to the east, and to the south, there would have not been the slightest reason for not having Quirinius assume the supreme command while concluding his procuratorial responsibilities. While with Saturninus gone to Rome in late spring of 2 BC, this would have left Quirinius as the full administrator until October or so. Something approaching this explanation might make some people think that Quirinius could have been considered the temporary governor of the province of Syria. Luke, however, in no way said that he was. The office that best suited Quirinius while he was performing his duties in conducting the registration of the people would be that of procurator. It is true that later, in 6 to 7 AD, Quirinius himself became what would more appropriately be called an official governor of Syria, which then included Palestine at that time. Though even here, he seemed to have special powers that normal governors did not have. A census was also taken at that time, and Luke referred to it in Acts chapter 5, verse 37, because the province officially became part of the Roman Empire in that year. But Justin's martyr's remark that Quirinius was a procurator when the census was taken at the Nativity of Jesus, yet he was full and undisputed governor at the census for taxation in 6 to 7 AD, helps distinguish the two different censuses. The explanation given in this chapter is reasonable and solves the difficulty at once. The statement of Luke can make good historical sense. Indeed, it could be said that Luke provides the key that shows who governed Syria from 3 BC on through the summer months of 2 BC. And indeed, why should Luke not be accepted? He was probably a native of Antioch, or certainly familiar with the area. He was writing to a Roman nobleman who surely would have been knowledgeable of Roman affairs. Luke was also a writer who lived much closer to the events than either Josephus or Dio Cassius of the early Roman historian. The simplicity and reasonableness of the explanation in this chapter is a strong point in its favor. And interestingly, using Occam's razor, that the simplest explanation is the best. And interestingly, this historical information harmonizes with the Pamphlagonian inscription and Tertullian, who quoted Roman records, and this all agrees with Justin Martyr, also quoting Roman records, and with Luke, who was writing to a Roman nobleman. The historians Aristeus and Moses of Cyrene, the Armenian historian, also confirm this point. This means that the census of Quirinius, which has eluded any positive identification by modern historians, is now found in several historical sources, and some of them right at the time the census occurred, according to the chronology of the New Testament and that of secular history. in a word, the census of Quirinius associated with the nativity of Jesus has been found. So ends chapter 12, the census of Quintilius Varus. And the next chapter, the next chapter is the chronology of Josephus, and that'll be fairly interesting and straightforward. That's the final chapter, the chronology of Josephus. So thanks again, George Ann.
Well, thank you, David. This is, it's amazing that that was discovered, that, you know.
Yeah, that the information's there. It just has to be looked at correctly and brought out and explained.
Wow. Well, anyway, everybody, you can read this book, The Stars That Astonished the World, if you go to the Ask Elm, that's askelm.com website. And there's a lot of books up there that you can read for free. So go have a look.
As an aside, all this material is footnoted, and you can look up the sources, and particularly the Josephus sources,
yes,
which Josephus is available online in many sources, because the Whiston translation is in public domain. So, you know, there's no reason that you can't read the words that Dr. Martin refers to from Josephus himself in English translation.
Very good. So this ends this particular segment, and we will be back, God willing. So God bless you, David, and your family, and all the listeners. And a special God bless to Rose. This is George M. Hughes with David Seeloff signing off. Good night, everybody.